Are you ready?
Okay, Smokey. Roll 'em. That's silly. Shoot him now! Shoot him now!
I gotcha!
Hello, everybody, and welcome to That's Not Quite All, Folks, a Looney Tunes podcast. I'm your host, Mark Callum, joined by...
And I'm Jordan Schmidt, doing a bad impression of Jackie Mason for some reason. Get back here, Rant. Would you believe we have a good podcast for you today? I don't think we do. I don't know what we even have. I've had nothing.
So today, you can tell, we are covering another part of the history of the Looney Tunes. Now, throughout our run, we've covered, you know, the early days, the golden era, the ending of Termite Terrence, and like we've done some later stuff. Like we did Seven Arts, famously.
Yeah, it was great.
And
I like Norman Norman.
You know what? Yeah, but you know, this time we're like, you know what? Because recently we've been covering a lot of John Dunn written material. We're gonna look at the Patty Freleng era material. And here's the funny thing, though. This wasn't planned. These aren't Warner de Patty Freleng materials. It's United Artists de Patty Freleng material, which I was not planning.
I honestly think it's perfect because, you know, with pretty much every Looney Tunes Termite Terrace writer or filmmaker from the golden age, you talk about Tex Avery, you talk about Chuck Jones, all of them have a moment where they leave Warner and end up at what they called Metro at MGM. And so You have Tex, obviously high profile. You have, I think Tashlin was Metro a little bit, Chuck famously, and Frizz's Metro era was, doing some of the Patty Freleng Pink Panther stuff, because that was under the MGM umbrella because the Pink Panther films were released by Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. And I find this very funny that we're recording this now because about all these Looney Tunes filmmakers that have been saved by Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. And I think about the fact that Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer is now owned by Amazon. And people are thinking that Amazon might be the savior of the Looney Tunes yet again. So
yeah.
I think that's fitting is all.
Yeah, very, very interesting how things wind up that way.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So the three shorts we'll be covering today are Nuts and Bolts from the Warner era, from near the end of the Warner run, The Pink Fink, which is the first Pink Panther short for good reason, ending with Dune Bug, a cartoon from the Ant and the Aardvark series that the Patty Freleng tried to kick off in the late 60s.
You know, the Ant and the Aardvark, your favorite characters.
Yeah.
The Ant and the Aardvark.
Or Anteater, or whatever the hell they call him. And you know, it's so funny, Jordan, doing research for this. I'm like, oh yeah, the Ant and the Aardvark. And so I'm like, oh yeah, they once with the television, the Ant and the Aardvark got really popular. They got their own segment in the Pink Panther show. They didn't make any new ones. They just reran the same 17 shorts over and over again. Just wow.
That's the Patty Freleng way. Why start trying now?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. Let's get to the death knell of the company, Mark.
Yeah, let's talk about a funeral. So the first show we're covering here is Nuts and Bolts. Oh. Came out on April 25th, 1964. Was that a doe?
I was doing the getting hit in the nuts sound.
Well, on this day, you know, if you were doing the doe sound effect, Jordan, it would fit because on this day, voice actor Hank Azaria, known mostly for being a Simpsons voice actor, Chief Wiggum, Apu,
Mo the Bartender,
F- famous talking head and later Looney Tunes Gold Collection bonus features. Yeah. He was born on this day. Also he's in The Birdcage, which is a really good movie.
Yeah, I was going to say he's in The Birdcage. He had a short run FX series called Brockmeyer that was very good about sportscaster. Yeah. He was in the scene from the movie Heat where Al Pacino goes, "She's got a great ass, and your head is all the way up it." Thank God for this new mic.
Yes, and monkey noises, Al Pacino impression. It's all making it worth it. But also, Jordan, he's in my opinion one of the few bright spots to Night of the Museum, Battle of the Smithsonian.
One I like, for the record. I actually really like the second one.
It has some moments. I can't hate a movie that has a scene with Oscar and Darth Vader in it. That's just too good for me. But, I don't know.
I like it more than I should. It's not my favorite of the three, because the sequels are kind of not as good as the first. But I like the second one. Hank Azaria is clearly one of the best parts of the second one.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Although, like, Amy Adams in that movie, like, she's bringing it.
She's
not even like in a hot way. So, she's giving her all in that one.
Yeah, familiar.
Yeah. Yeah, no, Hank Azaria, he's fucking great. We love his work, and we hope he keeps it up for as long as he can.
So, Nuts and Bolts were directed by Friz Freleng, written by John Dunn. Jordan, don't bother trying to do the John Dunn impression, because he wrote all three of these.
What impression? That's not like I know what he sounded like. Do you want me to come up with one now? I'll do my impression of John Dunn in 1982. "Hey, you guys should come up with something about, they go to a wishing well." Something like that.
Nuts and Bolts was the last Warner Brothers cartoon directed by Friz Freleng prior to the closure of Termite Terrence. I would say you can tell, but we've seen shorts from around this time. It's not like Friz was going, "Okay, last one. You're gonna really give the old college try," because nobody gave you shit by this point.
I mean, the thing about this one is that I don't know if it was the very last one that they finished, because the copyright in the very beginning of this says 63 rather than 64.
Oh.
So I don't know if this is like the end or just like the last one they plopped out.
Also, this has a prison credit by David DePatie. So, you know, it's starting to end. The telltale signs are there. Though the Warner rings are still there.
Yeah, that's the weird part. That all of this happens and the rings are still very much there. It's like, oh, this is technically a Looney Tunes cartoon.
It's so weird because, like, you know, it's like, it's the rings. Like, oh, yes, Looney Tunes. And then as soon as the title card comes up and the Bill Lava music kicks in, because you're darn tuned. Oh, no.
So much Bill Lava in this one. Just like, if you're a big fan of... It's just very funny if the big sweeping Carl Stalling ends, you know, da 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 da. And then you just go into...
It's not good. Right. It's not good. So, this is a Speedy and Sylvester cartoon.
Woo!
Everyone's favorite. And what I... So, right off the bat, we're in Mexico.
Yeah.
James Taylor's favorite place to get high. And here I'll talk about it. And they're running through Mexico. And we don't see this. We only hear it as a bunch of sound effects are played. Because, you know,
they can't animate it.
Actually, the weird thing is, when there is actual character animation on screen, it's actually not that far off.
It's actually
from like typical, like, it's still, the layout artists are still there, you know? It's not like we're at full crappy TV special quality yet. Like, there is still some fluid animation in this. It's just very lazy. the story wise, because we see Suspeed and Sylvester going into a house. Oh no!
Oh, no, not McKimson. No,
it's another one of those. I can't believe it's not McKimson cartoons.
Yes, I can't believe it's not McKimson.
Pretty much. So Sylvester tries to get Speedy. It doesn't work. Sylvester is lying on the ground, going,
"If I wasn't so pooped, I'd give you what for." Why not?
Yeah.
If only some plot device would come out of nowhere to get this thing going. And literally, a piece of paper just gets slipped through the door that's like, hey.
Oh, here's your plot.
Advance your home. Here's the plot. Go. And it's essentially, you know, Acme selling advanced home technology. You know, it's a smart home of its day, I guess.
The phrase in this one is, let the machine do the work, which is also coincidentally the slogan that SAG-AFTRA has been using in the last couple of days. Topical joke! You guys will hopefully still get by the time this goes out in early February, or whenever this goes out.
So Sylvester off-screen orders all this stuff, and our first one here is like this tracking device where if Speedy goes through it, Sylvester will get thrown out of this cat machine to get Speedy.
Shouldn't it supply its own cat, or would that be like competition with Sylvester? Or would that be an actual good plot?
I don't know, but I do like the expression where got Sylvester's face all ready to pounce onto Speedy. I like that. That was just a slam into the wall. The sound effects are still also here, so it doesn't feel too...
mostly.
So it's at this point we're introduced to the robot, and credits do. At least with this one, they introduced the robot in, like, Gag 2, and not like, well, shit, we don't have an ending. Robot. It's like...
No, the robot is actually part of the plot in this one, which is a step up, I think.
And also, I don't know about you, Jordan. Did you feel once we got into this robot section that the audio quality for Sylvester got a little bit worse?
Place Tralifaz Mark C into slots D and E. Connect wire X and YX to battery cable. Flare. That should do it. Now let's try it.
I think so. The audio quality in a lot of this got a little worse because, like, there was something about Mel as Sylvester in this one that had the sense of really tired recovering from the accident. Like, yeah, I don't know if that's exactly what it was, but he just sounded a little off. Not entirely off. He could still do the voice, but a little off.
It felt like he was through a phone. Like a really good phone connection, you know, but still.
Middle of the night, someone rings the blank residence. Hello? Now do your lines from Nuts and Volts. All of them, or your child dies. No, he's fine. Yeah, Noel's fine. The whole thing about this robot is that, like, first of all, Sylvester has this screen he can watch the action from. The screen will come into focus later on because we realize we don't know how the screen works. But through this screen on the machine that he has, the controls, the robot, he can, like, view where Speedy is and where the robot is and whatever. It's not very consistent, but neither is the cartoon. The cool thing is that he can actually speed up the robot, like, to almost Speedy speed. But, of course, you know, there's another run into the wall gag. And I will say, Sylvester struggling to hit the brakes at least got a smile out of me.
Yeah, a lot of this cartoon takes place in the house. So when this robot does chase Speedy, it's a lot of repeating backgrounds. It's very, like, we only got these, like, 5 backgrounds. We can't use any more. And the guys are going to be decently done enough. So in between each of these bits, it's Sylvester fixing up the robot. Sylvester's sending out the ambulance, like the ambulance robot, to fetch the robot to bring it back to him. Which, okay, nothing. The only funny guy we have out of this is a little bit later, but We have this second gag here with the robot. I don't quite know how this happens, but it gets to a point where, like, Sylvester is mangled with the robot.
Yeah, okay.
And I like the image of, as the ambulance taking Sylvester away, just Sylvester within the robot getting taken away. I'm like, okay, that's a funny image.
This is the one that pissed me off, because...
Oh, okay.
The thing about John Dunn is that there are slapstick possibilities that he's not even aware of. He's so hell-bent on his simple gags that he just leaves the window open for a much better gag. So the gag that begins with Sylvester pointing at his view screen where Speedy is and going, get him, that could have ended with the robot charging the supercomputer and breaking it. But no, Dunn needed that for a few more gags, apparently. So the way they end up doing that is a way that doesn't even make any sense, with the robot instead charging the camera and coming through the computer that way. Because it's not established where the view screen footage is coming from. Or, like, how Sylvester can watch...
Because Sylvester is seeing the feed like we would watching a cartoon. The camera...
Yeah.
The camera's in a place where the... I don't think by 1964 they're like, hey, let's do a POV shot of a robot looking through... Like, that's too much effort. That's way too much effort for them.
I will say, if they had better animation, what they could have done was have the robot come right at the screen and come literally through the screen and towards Sylvester and just make it the whole anti-logic bit there. But they didn't want to do that or animate it. It's just, it's an odd mishandled gag that just doesn't make any sense. And I don't think the next one makes much sense either.
Oh, yeah, this dynamite gag, which, like, listen, I'm gonna do this one more time, and if this doesn't work, I'm gonna send you back to the factory.
Yeah.
So, literally, it's just, you know, the robot has a stick of dynamite, puts it through Speedy's little house, and Speedy's just leading the robot on, and... Okay, I do kind of like we see inside the mouse hole a little bit. It's like, okay, at least... Because, like, right from the get-go, you know, like, okay, and then it's going to be behind Sylvester. And then it's going to be behind Sylvester. And then eventually, it'll be like, oh, senor. It's like, ah, gotcha. And then, of course,
boom.
So it sees the dynamite, goes inside the robot, and explodes.
Yeah, but the thing is that I don't understand... why the robot ends up following Sylvester and not Speedy into the back of himself. Because it just then seems like the gag is sewing itself rather than actual logic happening, and it's giving its own game away, really.
Well, the thing that annoyed me is actually the ending. Okay. Where Sylvester is like, you know what, that said, get out of here, go. And he leaves the house. I'm like, oh my God. That's how you know the cartoon's ending, because they actually leave the damn house. It's like, oh, through with you, throws it out as a robot dog all of a sudden shows up. As we pan back to reveal that Speedy has somehow ordered a robot dog to go after Sylvester.
Yeah.
Leading the final line of a frizz-frilling Warner Bros. Cartoon to go,
hey, I dig these electrical donics type stuff.
It's just such a limp. It's just like a... It's like a shrug. It's like, okay. Because Sylvester being chased by a robot dog is a good ending to this, but the fact that it's just Speedy going, hey, what do you know? Ba, 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 ba. That's not as good.
No.
No.
Woof. They haven't lost the animation budget quite yet, so the animation's pretty decent. There's some visual gags I got a chuckle out of, but besides from that, and it's something that I'll give the other, the show room covering next. Nothing about this felt like a Freeling short to me.
No.
Really. This felt like a McKimson cartoon. Mm-hmm. And McKimson cartoons are bad. And when I see a Freeling short, I expect a little bit more oomph behind it. Maybe a good music gag or two. But no, this is just... going through the paces. We gotta get this short done. Run out the clock, pretty much. Yeah. It leaves no impression. And the only thing that fascinated me about this was that this short is on the Looney Tunes Clone Collection drink.
It's on the fourth one, which has all Speedy Disc.
All Speedy Bits is the fourth volume. It's when they were like, okay, we have to put Sidgy stuff on these now. We ran out. We're out of the good stuff. And Jerry Beck does a commentary on it. And I'm going to listen to it after this because I didn't want any of his professionalism to like come down. Yeah.
It's probably just him watching it going, no, no, that's not good. No.
I mean, yeah, we remastered it. We preserved it, but at what cost? Did this really need to be preserved?
They preserved Old Glory. They don't care.
Yeah, sometimes.
Look, barely anything worked in this. The gags were limp. The characters didn't do anything funny. So much made no sense. The structure was very formulaic. Speedy barely did anything. Say what you will about Speedy Gonzalez. In other cartoons, at least he does things or says funny things. Here, he just does nothing. He's just there, and Sylvester just literally hoists his own petard. And Sylvester isn't even that funny in this. It's just a nothing burger of a cartoon and a very sorry state to end things at for the Warner unit.
I'm giving it a 1 out of 5 anvils.
That's exactly what I'm giving it, actually. It's very bad. Very, very bad. Very, very, very bad.
It's just nothing.
Nothing.
It's nothing. All right. Let's talk about something that has a little bit more something to it.
Oh, there's something to this one, all right. This next one is The Pink Fink, which was released on December 18th, 1964. Mark, you found a good voice acting on this day. I found a good pop culture. I found a good pop culture birthday on this day. I gave you clues when I sent you the message saying, "Hey, is this the one I do?" And I want to point out the clues that I sent Mark and the exact phrasing I used because I'm pretty proud of this one because I don't think you got who it was. I said, bottom line is, I found a cool on this day birthday for the second one. I'm glad I got it right. So if I were to say, if I were to make sure that you knew that the key phrase was, and that's the bottom line, who would I be referring to?
Oh, that's the bottom line. It's not a newscaster, is it?
No, far from it.
Oh, fuck.
If I told you that was a wrestling catchphrase of his, would that do you any good?
Oh, okay. It's not Hulk Hogan's birthday.
No, it's not Hulk Hogan. If I said, if this would give it away, but if I said, what comes before 316?
Oh, Stone Cold Steve Austin?
Stone Cold Steve Austin was born on this day in 1964. The wrestler, the media personality. What was that? Yeah.
He looks damn good for it. I had no idea he was that old.
He's 10 days old. No, Stone Cold. Again, you know that he's done something right if he's a wrestler I've heard of. Like, I don't keep up with WWE. I don't really fight. Like, I know you're like, if there's a name that escapes the lexicon, like, I don't know, like Roman Reigns or whatever, or the Garcias or whatever the fuck. Like, yeah, fine. But like, you know, Stone Cold, like that, of course, everybody knows Stone Cold Steve Austin. You know, that's a name you just know. Like, he was doing Tide ads with Ice-T a couple of years ago. It was Ice-T and Stone Cold Steve Austin cold calling people to tell them to put their washer on cold. And he used his catchphrase, and that's the bottom line. So,
I mean, I saw his Hot Ones a couple months ago, just on a Hot Ones binge. he did a really good Hot Ones episode.
That doesn't make any sense. Stone Cold on Hot Ones? That's just polarizing temperatures there.
Would you prefer Sean Evans to do a show called Cold Ones, and it's either Sean and Stone Cold drinking a whole lot of booze, or it's ice cream? It's just different types of ice cream.
Progressively sweeter flavors of ice cream. And he just, exactly. Instead of getting really intense, people gets like the sweet, like he's eating ice cream with, I don't know, with Maggie Smith or with Carol Burnett or with Henry Winkler. Oh, this is great pistachio. You know, can I call you Sean?
But like, you know, the sound effects were like, oh, wow, it's really getting to them. They use the same sound effects. except it's when they're getting a brain freeze.
Brain freeze. So like, yes. So
Carol, tell me more about the production of the Carol Burnett Show. Well, it was very nice and... Oh, wow! Oh, boy! That rocky road really hit me.
she gets brain freeze and does a Tarzan yell. All right. We've amused ourselves. Stone Cold Steve, I thought that was pretty cool. Stone Cold Steve Austin. Yeah. There's also another.
Oh, yeah.
There's another sports on this day. Born on this day, Bills and Packers wide receiver of the 80s and 90s, Don Beebe, was born on this day. So, number one song in the U.S., "Come See About Me" by the Supremes. Number one in the U.K., "I Feel Fine" by the Beatles. Closer than you might think. I might actually give it to the Supremes there.
Supremes are pretty good.
Yeah. Fucking Motown royalty right there.
Also, we always give it to the Beatles. Give it to the Supremes. Yeah, ones, you know,
it's a middling Beatles single versus one of the best Supreme singles. I'm giving it to Diana Ross and the Supremes. The Pink Fink, directed by Fritz Freleng with Holly Pratt, written by John Dunn. This one won the 1964 Best Animated Short Oscar. Because I believe they packaged this one with A Shot in the Dark. Don't quote me on that, but I'm pretty sure that's what they did. And Mark, have you ever seen A Shot in the Dark?
And wait, they packaged it with the movie.
The first Pink Panther came out, I believe, the year before.
Right. Yeah. So, and that one, I thought A Shot in the Dark was the only one that didn't have the Pink Panther in it. Because they didn't establish character yet.
Well, maybe that's why they put this short before it. Maybe. I don't know. This is apropos of nothing. But you ever seen that one, by the way?
I saw the first, 20 minutes of it one night because I was curious.
It's very good. I would say finish it. It's extremely good. It's one of my favorites. It's before the Pink Panther series became what it is, which is just, you know, over-the-top slapstick for blockbuster numbers. So, you know. Also, and I found this while looking up this cartoon, the Pink Fink, there is a Dexter's Laboratory cartoon called A Silent Cartoon, which is a homage to this. Where it's Dexter and Dee Dee painting the house or doing something. That's the same color scheme, I believe. So that's important.
Yeah.
Okay. So the Pink Fink has a very simple setup and proof of concept. The painter, which is this sort of Sado Inspector Clouseau character, is trying to paint the house blue. The Pink Panther wants to paint it pink. That's all you need. Gags follow. Even the initial gag where the painter looks for a blue can of paint and then finds it gets immediately bowled over by the panther opening a door. That works for me. It's just like you just see the mess of paint behind the door.
There's good slapstick throughout this cartoon and another for his inclination. Like, oh, wait a minute. That was actually really good. And time to music. We're back to time to music gags, everybody.
Yeah, well, because you have the Henry Mancini score in addition to some more Bill Lava.
Which, okay, this is what got me curious. Because, okay, first of all, yes, you have the classic Henry Mancini score. And I love how, because like in all the Looney projects, Bill Lava is credited as Bill Lava. And then we go to United Artists. With the big money and the prestige. So in the credits, he's credited as William Lava.
No more of this Bill shit. I'm William. William Lava.
William, damn it.
Call me Dr. Lava, William Lava.
I'm going to put some prestige onto this. Ow.
No more fish-posh bill shit.
Now, where is my orchestra? Oh, we still have the same instruments. We like two strings and a guitar. Well, shit, we'll make it work.
No, it'd be even funnier if it was like, yes, I am now William. Take me seriously. I am a serious composer. 2, 3, 4. Wait, why are you all leaving and laughing? I'm serious, what? Bill William Lava now.
What I will say, the music's okay. Good in this. I don't know what bits. Honestly, I think it's just a simple case of Bill. William was just given the Henry Mancini score and just went, okay, sure.
Maybe they worked together with this. Maybe Bill Lava was like, wait a minute, I have to meet an actual working composer? Screw this Bill shit. I'm William now. I have to look better than I am, or else he's going to know I'm a fraud. That's a movie right there. It's like, you know, it's making himself into a new person to disguise the fact that he's like a terrible composer. It's like, yes, William Lava. No, Bill. Bill doesn't exist. I'm William. I compose very impressive orchestrations. Oh, yeah, let's see some. Okay, that's just a warm-up. And it's just about like whether or not he's going to be able to pull it off if the jig is up or not. Your compositions sound really similar to Bill Lava's. Oh, that hack? I don't think so. Lava voice is just Billy Zane from Titanic.
Pretty much. I had to bring that up.
Go on. Yes, of course. No, I'm glad you did. Because, you know, William Lava. So we have a lot of very quick gags here, and because of the pacing and the movement of this cartoon, they all really work. The gag where they just paint halves of the room in their own color without knowing, like one does the bottom while the other does the top, and they don't know.
And then they switch it. Oh yeah.
Yeah, it's great. I also love the flagpole gag where they're painting the flagpole as they turn around, and the other one comes around and paints the other way. And again, I had a big smile on my face for most of this because it's just a really fun mentality of like, okay, they're both ragdolling through it, and only the painter is the one that gets pissed at it. So that's a pretty funny combo there.
And also, something that I realized while watching this is that very simple backgrounds. This is kind of coming from that Norman Normal / Now Hear This cartoon mentality, which is, oh, what's that? We can't afford to do big, extravagant backgrounds anymore or very indicative character designs. Okay, let's work with that. And yeah, for the first time ever, it seems, from the Freeling and John Dunn partnership, that they're actually able to work it out pretty well. And yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. And yeah, that's pretty much the model of this whole episode, really. It's like they were able to learn, you know? And it's good.
That's great. First of all, I love that because the whole thing is that like the Pink Panther gets away and the painter sees these pink paw prints, and the first thought to what the pink paw prints are from is a mouse. No, wrong cartoon. But the next bit where the Pink Panther's blending into the wall, and the inspector and the painter puts a finger down the wall. What am I to make of him doing that? And you hear the sound of the Pink Panther giggling. It's like, especially when he does that. Like, where was he touching the panther?
Sir, please point out on the doll where he struck you.
Well, I can't. I mean, the painter must have been confused. He sees a pink thing and he's got to put his finger to it. Anyway, anyway, use your judgment whether or not that goes in.
You know, you can tell this painter hasn't been laid in a while. Because he knows it's two in the pink, one in the stink. And he was clearly only doing one in the pink, which, like, come on. That's
what that means. Okay.
Tossing salad. Anyways.
How is it that you know more of these terms than I do?
You don't know where I go to at night.
Yes. Mark the dark side. Mark in the dark. All right. So I love how after this bit, the painter crosses out mouse in his head and writes big mouse. Fritz Freleng is still, at the end of the day, Fritz Freleng. And he can do gags like that. Now, what impressed me the most in this cartoon, I think, was this next mousetrap gag, which is so good. At a revolving door pace, in then out. It moves so smoothly and so quickly. It's seamlessly, where it's like, okay, he moves the mousetrap, and then something goes wrong, and he ends up going back with the mouse. It flows perfectly.
Yeah, I loved all this going on, and then very quickly, a mouse does show up and takes the cheese and runs.
Oh, perfect.
I love that. I love that. It's a good call.
There's some quick gags here. The barn doors gag is pretty simple. I wish it could have kept going because we just finish when he turns it around and they're both pink. I wish the painter would have come back and gone, doo! I mean, he doesn't talk, but I know that every single time he gets frustrated, he just has that sort of doo, which is the best kind of cartoon frustration, the sort of why I oughta kind of thing, which the painter does a lot in this, and I kind of love that. Also, the bit where he paints the stairs and the Pink Panther
drips
down the stairs, and the painter just madly hops back up the stairs.
And this is when I really like the music here. That's really fascinating about this, is that we know what the Pink Panther theme is because we've heard it our lives. And I like how, because it was the first one, pretty much the entire thing is just the theme, but the little motifs they throw in there to match it to the gag work, it fits in with the theme. So you know he was probably working with Henry. There's no way Pilaf would have been able to incorporate gag music within a great piece of music and have it all come together so well.
Yeah, no, it really is impressive. But I also love things this cartoon does just without really trying. Like the bit where he paints the room and the Pink Panther is able to use a device to paint the whole thing pink. And the double take the painter has after the room gets repainted is perfect. Like, he just comes in, it's like, it's great. And then, because this is, not McKimson, we go outside the house. And this whole bit where he's painting the outside of the house, and it turns into the painter filling his shotgun with blue paint and trying, or with pink paint or something.
Pink paint.
I think it was pink paint, yeah. And trying to hit the Pink Panther and missing and getting the whole household made up pink. Because ain't that America, you and me? Ain't that America? Salt in the sea, baby. Ain't that America? Home free. Little pink house is for you and me. I don't even like John Mellencamp. That's the weird part.
It's okay. John Mellencamp doesn't like John Mellencamp.
He's got some good songs. I'll give him that. His
90s. I know. But whenever I see John Mellencamp now, I just see a guy who like, all of his songs are pretty much about being young and stay young forever. And now he's not young anymore. Yeah. So he kind of has this kind of like, I'm going to sing this song up.
Yeah. There is some kind of ballsiness to doing a song with like a 5-minute intro.
I could have this go on for the full 5 minutes. Sorry, I love that guitar part so good. Alright, I think I'll stop it right here. And stop.
and then just going right into, I need a lover that won't drive me crazy. like, okay, that is not at all befitting of the big orchestral sweeping guitar thing you began the song with. It's like, oh yeah, this is great. What are we talking about?
No,
we're talking about a love. Yeah, he's talking about a girl.
I'll say my this very recent John Mellencamp concert moment is he was at it was like an intimate show because he does those now. He does like intimate acoustic shows. And he does Jack and Diane, and he's singing the song. It's like, okay. No, everyone's singing it. Yeah. And the entire audience, I think they skipped a verse or a bridge or something. So it's like, no, wait. Listen, I wrote the song. I know how it goes. You all skipped up because they all want to get to the chorus. It's like, no. There's this bit.
No.
Forgot about this bit. So.
I'm the one who sings.
You guys must have been absent the day they taught songwriting 101. Songs have things called verses, and then they have choruses, and then sometimes they have bridges, and then you have instrumental passages. So anyway, this song has two verses and then goes to the chorus. You motherfuckers just jump straight to the chorus.
It was all like light fun. He wasn't like actually pissed off at the audience.
Essentially pointing a gun at the audience for liking a song, like how Nicki Minaj or Mike Love will do. But yeah, John Mellencamp. I adore this ending gag and this ending more than I've adored an ending of something in a while, because the painter buries all of the pink paint in the ground, covers it, and then the paint gets into the soil and it grows pink grass, and the whole landscape of the land is pink. And it's so the shot of the panther turning around and seeing this and just smiling with complete joy. I love that shot so much. He buys the house.
And the panther's hitting his head up against the mailbox as we just see the panther lovingly going to his new pink house as the cartoon fades. And yeah, it's a really good ending. It brings the whole thing, it brings it home.
It's the best way to end it, because the pink panther wins and the painter loses, and both have a funny ending. It's great. Oh my God. Not only has the panther lost, but he's lost in a completely irreversible way in that he still wins and sells the house. But he sells it to the person who's ruined the house in his eyes.
It's, the painter really got screwed. You're right, he got screwed over, but he still got paid, you know? So
it's the Warner Brothers way, getting screwed over but still taking your money away with you. So in conclusion, I loved this. Amazing gag mentality, such a simple premise done so well. Great use of minimalism and colors, a fantastic ending. There's little bits and pieces that like prevent me from giving it the full, but like I really liked this one, and I think it proved that Friz Freleng could do cool things, that John Dunn could do cool things outside of their usual Warner Brothers wheelhouses. They could use characters like these and make something classic.
Yeah, I mean again, this is something that I brought up, but like, who would have guessed that the less is more approach do wonders for Friz and John Dunn? By doing more simpler gags at the music, which honestly harkens back to Friz's strengths as a director, timing gags to music. And when you have them in a store by Henry, it just elevates things amazingly. I still don't quite believe Bill Lava actually did stuff for this cartoon entirely, because it seems more like he's our early composer, so contractually we have to say Bill Lava did something. So.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, maybe he helped a little bit.
He gave Henry the conductor stick. It's like, here you go, Henry. Thank you. What's your name?
William.
Right.
You got it, Billy. Fuck. My name is William. Get it right, Mancini. Get it right. Oh, hey, how's it going, Bill? Shut up, Fritz.
Welcome to Schizophrenic Theater.
No, it doesn't. Shut up. Yeah. Welcome to Jordan Wears Out His Throat. The end of the episode, I'm just going to be like, hello and welcome to That's Not Quite All, folks.
Oh, yay.
Yeah, this gets a 4.5 out of 5 for me. Maybe I should give it a 5, but it's incredible and I love it.
Yeah, I'm being a little more conservative. I'm going to give it a 4 out of 5 annuals.
And you're allowed. This is just very much my shit, and I love it so. And even if it isn't completely stellar, if it isn't completely perfect or immaculate, I really enjoyed my time with this. I was smiling ear to ear for most of it.
It definitely feels like a proper cartoon. You know, that's something that we noticed when watching the old Japan Freeling stuff. Is that like?
Yeah. It deserved the fuck out of that Oscar too.
Yeah. Yeah. But who are the other nominations?
Oh, I forgot to mention. This was the only American cartoon nominated, because the other three were two from a Czechoslovakian production company and one from a Canadian production company. So the USA wins out over those nasty foreigners. No, I'm just kidding.
The Pink Panther. That's who saved the day.
Yep. The Pink Panther, a film series starring an Englishman playing a Frenchman.
Yes.
God bless America.
All right. So the last short we're covering here is Dune Bug. It came out on October 27th, 1969, which I got to admit, that kind of threw me for a loop. Like, oh, wow. The end of the 60s. Shit. Okay.
Yeah.
Number one song in the U.S., Suspicious Minds by Elvis Presley. Number one song in the U.K., Sugar Sugar by the Archies.
I got a different number one in the U.K.
Oh, what was your number one in the U.K.?
I got I'll Never Fall in Love Again by Bobby Gentry, which, to me, that is too on the nose for a song from 1969, because there's not a ton of movies specifically set in 1969, but... Say there was a movie that you watched a lot as a kid that was set in 1969, famously set in 1969. I might have even slipped in a reference when you mentioned it was 1969. Say that movie had a cover in the middle of the movie, a random impromptu cover of I'll Never Fall in Love Again by Bobby Gentry, sung by Elvis Costello and Burt Bacharach. You would call that too on the nose to say that the one short we do from 1969 had a number one song that was I'll Never Fall in Love Again by Bobby Gentry.
What do you get when you fall in love? A guy with a pin to burst your bubble. That's what you get for all your trouble. I never fall in love again. I never fall in love again.
Yeah, baby!
I am, of course, referring to the Blair Witch Project. No. It's Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me, which I watched a lot as a kid, because it's a very funny movie.
We watched it. The past December, my dad was dropping hints pretty much since like September, like, you know what I really like? Austin Powers movies. So I'm like, okay, I'm gonna get Austin Powers trilogy. I got the Austin Powers trilogy for the holidays, and I told him, like, you know you probably showed this to me at way too young of an age, right? He's like,
but it was just so
really funny though.
Oh my god. Like, the thing is, they're lewd movies, but at the same time, there is this sort of respect and heart to them, especially the first two, which, like, you know, it's Austin is this respectful character that tries to do right by himself and right, you know, he's still, you know, yes, he's a, you know, he's a sexaholic or whatever, but the hell, But he still feels for people, and you know, it, Mike Myers gives those movies a heart. It's not just fart jokes and cursing and shit. You know, it's, you know,
no.
But yeah, it's songs. It's a cover of "I'll Never Fall in Love Again" by Elvis Costello and Burt Bacharach.
Very nice, very nice. Yeah. So, Dune Bug was directed by Arthur Davis. He got directing crew back again.
But written by John Donne, music by Phil Lapin in 1969. It's in the wrong time. It's the wrong time for Art Davis.
Damn it.
Why?
So, this short is a part of the Ant and the Aardvark series of shorts done by Patty Freeling. It would be one of the few very original characters done by this unit.
Original? It's based off of a comedian that already existed.
Yeah, so Jackie Mason was the main inspiration behind the Aardvark character. He's not voiced by Jackie Mason, by the way. He's voiced by...
Yeah, who would think that for the last 27 years? I genuinely... My dad thought it was Jackie Mason. I grew up thinking it was Jackie Mason. It's not. It's John Byner, who also does the Ant, who's doing a Dean Martin impression as the Ant.
Oh, is that what that was?
Thought, yeah, that's what it was. I genuinely thought that he was doing it was actually Jackie Mason, but it's not. It was a impression of Jackie Mason, who, so it's basically, it's like Jerry Colonna, the worm, where it's just like, let's just take this performer's onstage persona and make a, it's like the W.C. Fields thing we did.
Yeah. I remember that. But yeah, now if you want to hear the actual Jackie Mason on cartoon.
Like Father, Like Clown.
Yeah, go watch those. Hey Jordan, remember when it was like season like 30 or something of The Simpsons? Yeah. And they're like, hey, we're going to kill off a character. And it was like, it could be anyone. And it was like, yeah, we're killing off Krusty's dad because Jackie Mason's like 85 and we want to actually have not be tethered to an aging comedian to do this guest role.
They went, well, it's someone that won an Emmy for the role. It could be anyone. And I'm like, well, it's just the voice actors there and then Jackie Mason, and you keep bringing back Jackie Mason. So maybe it's that one. It could be anyone. It's Jackie Mason, isn't it? Oh, yeah, it is.
Yeah. So, yeah. No, also, you know, because why the fuck not? What's your familiarity with Jackie Mason besides The Simpsons? I don't know. Do you have any?
Caddyshack 2? I don't know.
Oh, shit. Okay, never mind.
There are certain Jewish families that have a history of spending time in the Catskills, and so if you spend enough time in the Catskills, you know of comedians that are very similar to Jackie Mason, of just the sort of Borscht Belt type, like, you know, Jewish guilt comedians. It's the circuit that raised Billy Crystal, essentially. And Jackie Mason was one of the big ones of those, where his whole thing is just the sort of the not stereotype, but his whole thing was that he was the over the top sort of, you know, New York Jew type. And you know, that was his bit for years. You know, I'm Jackie Mason. What do you want? Come back here, rent. And so,
yeah. So, DeBerry Freeling was like, hey, let's just make an entire cartoon series out of this. I mean, 17. So, I think Frizz only did the first one. I think he only did the first one. A lot of it went to either, like, Holly Pratt or Gary Jerquin. And Arthur Davis, who got a directing crew back after famously being a director of Warner Brothers because, was it because Clampett left?
I think it was either Clampett or Tashlin.
Yeah, like they left and they're like, okay, new director, Davis, you're in. And they're like, okay, never mind, we got someone else.
Never mind, even though you're really good, we got to yank it away from you now. McKimson, you can still have yours for some reason.
Yeah. But now in this new era, they hired him as a director, which is really good because he's a really good director when he had the money.
Yes.
Okay.
And he actually has a unit that can do good animation because this is not good animation in this one.
And the one more thing before we get into it. This was a patron suggestion. One of our patrons over there, welcome to Patreon, James Irish, was the one who recommended this short because he really, really liked it. So before we get any more critical, thank you, James, for the suggestion. If you want to hear us on his show, the Pammy and James Concert Frank Corkin podcast, we were recently on there talking about Donald Duck cartoons.
It was a really fun time. We really enjoyed ourselves on that podcast. Yeah. So listen to it and enjoy it if you haven't already.
Okay, let's go into this Dune buggy.
The way I would describe the Ant and the Aardvark to someone who's never seen an Ant and the Aardvark cartoon is, what if Sylvester and Tweety couldn't shut the fuck up? And that's the Ant and the Aardvark.
Because
we meet the ant and it's and the ant won't shut up, and then the aardvark appears and the aardvark won't show up, and they're running around the beach and it's get back here, ant. Come back here, ant. What are you supposed to do, ant? Oh yeah, baby. I was going. That's Bing, but I can't do it, Dean. Well, I was just going to go over there and check on some picnic.
One thing I know as watching this is that the ant has no personality.
None.
Like, give Tweety this. Like, Tweety has a personality. Tweety can be chaotic.
Oh, so much of a personality.
This ant he's just vibes, man. He's just
at least the Jerry Colonna worm had a character.
Yeah. I mean, given that does mean all personality goes to the aardvark, and I did enjoy to an extent the aardvark's
but it's at times he could be a bit much. A lot of what he says in this isn't as funny as it is, you know, amusing, like, oh yeah, it's Jackie Mason as an aardvark, you know, but there's not a lot of like snappily written lines. Like there's one or two, but like he's just sort of like kvetching the whole time. And, you know, there's only so much you can get from that. Because the hook of this cartoon is they're at the beach and there is a lifeguard that keeps spotting the aardvark. And because there are no dogs allowed on the beach without a leash, he keeps chucking the aardvark out because he thinks he's a dog, despite the fact that the aardvark says about 20,000 times this, no, I'm not a dog, I'm an aardvark. And it sounded more like Gumby, but there you go. But it's just, but if you thought that rule of threesing the robot in the first short we covered was bad, the lifeguard must have thrown the aardvark off the beach 100 billion times.
It's a very repetitive joke. You know, I don't think Uncle Phil threw out DJ Jazzy Jeff out of the House of Fresh Prince the amount of times that the lifeguard throws out the aardvark.
And it's supposed to be a fun hook for the cartoon, but it doesn't build on itself. It's just like, it just happens at the end of every gag. Like, oh, this doesn't work. And then he gets thrown off the beach again. And there are slight ways to get around it, but they don't really work either, because a lot of these gags aren't great because the animation is not there for them to be great and the music is not very good for it to be cut to. So it's just this patchy, all these things aren't really in place. And then just, and occasionally interesting things happen. Like, what am I to make of the aardvark taking the pants off a sunbather?
I like that gag. I like that gag. But more because of the implications.
Yeah.
Just like, oh, yeah. That man is now bearing it all for sea thanks to this aardvark. You fucking weirdo.
What if he reaches back in there looking for the ant and finds something else? Get back here, ant! Oh, ooh.
Oh, I got you. Ouch!
Frizz looking at that in the animation room and just solemnly shaking his head no.
So what we're saying is Adult Swim pick up Ant and the Aardvark and just go full-blown Ren Stimpy's adult cartoon with the ant and the aardvark.
Who would play the aardvark in modern Adult Swim? Who would play the aardvark? Who would they get for that? Nick Kroll.
Well, no. That would be if Netflix got him.
It would
have been that. Anyway.
But yeah, there's lots of gags that don't work here.
So the moment where I went, oh, this is just a certain 3D cartoon, is the water bit where the ant's like surfing in the ocean. So the aardvark just puts on this submarine outfit and jumps into the ocean. I'm like, one, this could have been a special Tweety bit, and two, for some reason it reminded me of like a Tom and Jerry cartoon on the beach.
A little.
Like, I feel like that's a very similar type of joke. And the aardvark gets inflated. Don't read into that. And it just explodes. And the aardvark's like, well, it's good thing I'm planning for everything. Falls down right in front of the lifeguard. Oh. The lifeguard like, how many times do I have to tell you this? Get off the beach. And just punches the aardvark, which, hold on. The lifeguard thinks the aardvark's a dog. Right?
Yeah.
So he just punched a dog in the face.
Oh, Pete is going to be pissed.
Oh, man.
Hey, what do you want? No, but there's just lots of gags that not only don't work, but like aren't done. Like the parts where the aardvark is just in the ocean, like, and he's the same color base. He's two shades off from the color of the water. So already that's kind of awkward. Like, okay, you can only really see the outline. You know, why not just get a better color for the water? There's a bit where there's a seagull that makes a chicken noise and then lays a chicken-sized egg. So they messed up their bird etymology. I mean, they're far from the Freeling days. And just the stockiness of this animation, just things keep going. And like, even the aardvark stuck in a trash can getting hit by a car doesn't get a laugh out of me because of how badly it's animated. It's so choppy.
Yeah. Also, there's a moment where, he does a line about suing. Like, I'll sue. Then he gets ran over by a truck. Huh, that was my lawyer. But eventually, we're shown another human being. It's a old lady who isn't June Foray, right? Like, I think that's June
I don't
Foray.
Think so.
It's legally not June Foray, okay? It's like, you know, okay, Fifi, we're going to the beach. And then to the aardvark, finally, yeah, I mean, like, this should have been, like, gag two. Just, like, oh, I'll pretend to be a dog. Like, yeah, no shit. Like, how else is this going to work? So he just... this is the one bit I was like, okay, this is kind of funny because of how dark it is. Just... takes the poodle, because like he's in a trash can, takes the poodle, switches places, leaves the dog in the trash can. It's like,
yeah,
oh.
And then the dog chases after him, pissed off. Yeah. I liked that.
Yeah, it's like, okay. And I feel like the switch between the old lady going like, stop, take that. And just the lifeguard going, excuse me, miss, let me take care of that for you. Thank you. And that.
It sort of works.
Yeah, there's some bits here that are okay.
There's this line where the ant says one of the single worst lines of dialogue I have ever heard in one of these cartoons. Where the ant says,
I love to build sandcastles in the sand.
This ant has no character, no good dialogue, nothing to work with. And a line like that, which is so poorly written, just sinks this cartoon. I don't know what they were trying to do with that.
So the aardvark comes back and is like, damn it, ants! I'll get you! I'm gonna kick your damn house down! Ugh! Kicks it, hits it an anchor. Like,
liked that.
Oh, gee! Yeah.
The friggin' game show sound effect. Cutting!
And he gets thrown out again.
Yeah.
As he's in, for some reason, as he's in the sewer, he's like, aha, I'll pretend I'm in the Navy. And then we get this, oh, listen, the Bill Lawland music isn't great, of course. But like, what do you think of this moment where the music just cuts out as we have a whistle of like a nautical, like sort of, whistle.
Looks like the only way to see the sea is join the Navy.
I as the music kind of comes back in. Was that a little bit jarring to you?
A little.
How does he get figured out? Like, and the lifeguard just sees right through it, right? He's like, nope, screw this. I'm calling the dog catcher.
Yeah.
As the most Patty Freeling looking human just walks right into frame.
Badly animated person. And it leads us to the end of this where he's in the dog catcher truck trying to convince the actual dog that he is a dog, and then the ant or somebody going, no, that's a cat, and then him getting mad. Very, very limp. The animation and music just sour some actual good things in this one. There's not a great deal that's good anyhow, save for a few all right gags, but it's just very limp and it just sort of thuds along, and there's a lot of gags that just take up space, and it's just very monotonous. And there's some promise here. The aardvark isn't a terrible character. There's actually some decent things about him, but it just didn't really, it underwhelmed me, and it just sort of splayed out into the ground. It not great.
I didn't think it was that bad.
Okay.
Yes, it's a very basic character A, one's character B, because they don't like him story. The aardvark had a character. Yes, he's just a Jackie Mason impression, but the material they give this character is decently funny. Yes, this is very much like a discount Sylvester and Tweety sort of mentality, but I think in 1969, if I'm Friz Freleng, I'm like, well, I can't do Sylvester and Tweety cartoons anymore. I know. I'll do this. It's not quite like the legally copyright not Sylvester and Tweety, but very much like, hey, we're a new studio. We want to make something that resembles something great we did. So like, okay, well, instead of Sylvester and Tweety, it'll be an ant and an aardvark.
Sure.
But yeah, it's fine attempt. I just don't know how exactly it hit off with audiences. I don't know. I just find that fact, though, it's so damn funny. It's like, yeah, the Anthony and Arthur really hit off in the TV era. They just reran the same 17 shorts over and over again. It's like, wow. Like, they couldn't even get to 20, you know? Or at least get to 20. But no.
19 was the lucky number back then. I'm giving this a 1.5 out of 5.
I'm going to be a little more generous. I'm going to give it a 2.5 out of 5.
And that's fine. You know, we were able to have different opinions here. It just wasn't great.
All right. Let's see what you guys have to say about these Da Patty Freeling cartoons.
Frequent commenter Cody at Whisper of Sea seemed to be very excited that we were covering some Pink Panther cartoons in this one. He says, I love Pink Panther so much. The Pink Fink, while not in my favorite shorts, is a great introduction to the two opposing characters and their hijinks against one another. Also, Paint Wars is always fun. Yeah, no, I think this is a really good starter one if you want to get into these Pink Panther Da Patty Freeling cartoons.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, we're big fans of the Pink Panther stuff that they did. And if that's the case, maybe we'll do some more someday, because I like the one we did.
Yeah. So we have a comment here. From James Irish through the Pemmy and James podcast account. By his own admission, he wrote a lot, so we're going to summarize a little bit, because it's a lot. When TNT was running blocks of old cartoons in the early 90s, with libraries they owned, such as the MGM cartoons and the AAP library of Popeye Looney Tunes shorts, they'd also show some Pink Panther, and the Inspector, and the Ant, and the Aardvark. I was certainly aware of the Pink Fellow before this, but these airings were an introduction to the other two series. After that, I have a lot of nostalgia for them. It would only be as an adult I would learn just how much more they did, but there is a bigger, more interesting point rather than just me prattling on about their history, you know, like I normally do. So the issue Da Patty Freeling runs into, for me, James, is they were every bit as married to the content main cartoons for the sake of filling programming quotas for TV as the Warner Bros. Was at the time, roughly half a decade after that point, too. The Anthony Aardvark may be my favorite thing John Dunn ever worked on. I know, he can't stand that guy, I get it, but at least these shorts play more to his strengths.
To be honest, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, the bullshit John... I think... 95% of the reason why John Donne's shit is terrible is most of it does come from the fact of, like, he's writing for characters that we've seen be better. So, like, when we see a Daffy and Speedy in a cartoon together, it's like, what are you guys doing? This is shit. We've seen you be better. But no, it's written by a writer who doesn't know how to write these damn characters. Yeah. And they were massively popular on television in the early 70s. But despite the popularity, they stopped making them after 17 shorts and the full season on Saturday morning alongside Pink Panther and Inspector cartoons. Yeah, we brought that up. It's like, hey, they're so popular. It's only 17 of them.
Yep.
Meanwhile, thinner premises for subsequent short subject series like Mr. Jaws, the more derivative ones like Hook Kloot. What a name. James says here. What the God's name are
these? You see, this is the thing. Like, you run into ones that have evaded our grasp and are stuff that, like...
They sound made up. I know they aren't. But they sound like... yes. It sounds like a cartoon you would make up in a show to not legally have to say that.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, yeah, hey, guys, roll over to my house. What's on? Hookity stookity. Oh, man, I love hookity stookity. Let's go. That's what it sounds like. And it's real. Similarly, Harry 17 shorts and even Frizz's penchant for recycling his gags goes back as early as the 1950s. Well, I imagine that might be part of why TNT never ran anything past those first three series. I also have to imagine Frizz was partially relieved when Marvel Comics entered the picture and bought the studio, even as David DePatie bristled under working for the comics publisher, but those are stories for other days. Yeah, that is the end of the DePatie Frilling story. Marvel Studios came in, and it's those 60 series. It's the Spider-Man 60 show and Spidey and his amazing friends, which technically was Ryan under what used to be a Frizz Freeling animation studio, which means absolutely not. I was going to make a joke that like that
Spider-Man is a Looney Tunes character.
Well, no, because then, like, Anthony Arfark sure as fuck is a Looney Tunes character, you know?
Yeah, fair.
Like, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good point, James.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for giving that perspective.
Before we get to what we're covering next week, I would like to take this opportunity to thank our Patreon subscribers. That's right, we have a Patreon. If you didn't know about it, you know now. On Patreon, you can subscribe to That's Not Quite All Folks and get plenty of goodies, such as commentaries, bonus material, full uncut episode logs, and lots of fun stuff that you will get the opportunity to have at a $1 level or a $5 level. And I would just like to thank our current patrons, including Andrew, Triscrew, James Irish, Sam Adams, the person, not the drink, my cousin Neil, and Judy M. for giving to this wonderful podcast. And if you'd like to be a part of that, go to patreon.com/TNQAF. Trust me, it'll be worth it. So are we still in the throes of infuriation next week?
No, Jordan, because this next one we're covering next week was your idea.
Oh.
So what we're covering next week is, okay, so if you listen to this show, which we have, one of our frequent complaints is when we're watching a cartoon, usually like a Looney Tunes cartoon we haven't seen in a while, and then it's like, it's good. And then a really, like, off-color moment happens that pisses us off. We're like, fuck. Okay,
where did that come from?
Damn it. I was going to give this a 4 out of 5, but you went racist on me, so it's a 2.5 now. God damn you.
I'm talking about Sweetie and the Beanstalk. Yeah.
Pretty much. But, you know, there's always... So, what Jordan put together, because, again, it's one of your ideas, is... What if we did an episode
just of that?
Now, Jordan, I don't know if you want us to bypass our tendencies when we get to these. Like, I think that's
what
your
tendencies
idea.
Are you referring to? Because we have a lot of tendencies.
I don't know, like, with these shorts we're coming next week, are we allowed to deduct Anvil points if we don't like the racist shit in it? Or are we
not going to say, that's like, no, point. You have to be, like, respectful of these. Like, no, one of these has, like, really... mean, like, you know, stereotypes towards Polynesian people. I forget what the other two did, but they're pretty mean too. I think one of them's Aladdin is Lamp. I think that's also like racist towards like people in the Middle East, and we don't need that right now. Yeah, I forget what the other two were, but I know one.
The other one is okay. So the ones we're covering next week are Waka Kiki Wabbit.
Yeah,
Aladdin Has Lamp.
Okay, I did do that.
Ending with The Rebel Without Claws, which you can find on the Looney Tunes Collector's Choice Volume 2.
The Rebel Without Claws. Hang on.
It's a Sebastian Tweedy cartoon that takes place during the Civil War.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay. So we'll do that one as well. I forgot I put that one on there. Cool. Amazing. Yeah. These are cartoons that may not have aged very well that we are going to dissect for better or for worse. One of which, one of these in particular, I feel that we really should cover for reasons pertaining to two of the characters that our heroes get to meet and who they're caricaturing. And also because it's a classic cartoon that we really should get to. The rest of these, we'll try.
Yeah, so stay tuned next week for that. The episode's going to be rated TVMA.
Oh, God. Rated R for racism.
Exactly.
Rated N.
No. I'm gonna end the show now.
Rated N for mature. That was a stupid joke.
I can't put that. All right, so that's the end of this week's show. If you want to follow us on Twitter, follow me at MarkCallum1995.
You can send your hate mail at that joke to Tall Guy Schmidt.
I'm gonna have to keep it. if you like to keep up with the podcast or give your thoughts for either next week's show or that joke, you can follow us at @that_loony, both on Twitter and Instagram, or time in the podcast title, we are the first result.
I should have said nature. N for nature. Okay, that would have worked better.
Too late now.
What's nature? Like either way, I'm good. And you can also find our podcasts wherever podcasts are available, and that includes Apple Podcasts, Spotify Podcasts, Player FM, Amazon Music. We have a YouTube channel where we post clips from episodes. We also post shorts on there that are also on our TikTok account that we have for some reason. And if you like what you're hearing and you want to help out the podcast, go to www.patreon.com/TNQAF.
All right. So until next week, I'm Mark.
And I'm William Jordan Schmidt. And I'm going to go conduct my symphony of a bunch of fart noises and see if it gets any recognition. Good night.